This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, yes, the sector I stole for Tim for the top of our 3 p.m. simulcast, it is the semiconductor index, the SOX. We are seeing chip stocks jump today. Samsung Electronics coming out with a better than anticipated jump in revenue. And that really just sent the whole sector booming in the U.S. trade. I mean, it also sent it booming over in the Asia trade overnight.
Yeah, but really interesting commentary coming from our own Ryan Vestelica and Subrat Patnaik. All about the chip supply chain. We've talked so much about it, Carol, and over the last 2 years, how it has been really a challenge, not just for automakers, but for anyone who wanted a chip. It's actually getting harder to trade because not all chips are created equal. Ryan Vestelica is equities reporter for Bloomberg News, and he joins us on the phone from Chicago. Ryan, great to have you with us. I want to go back to this idea that not all chips are the same here, because we are starting to see a glut in some types of chips, but others are still hard to come by. Please explain.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously, different chips are used in different types of product categories, and we are seeing differences in demand and supply depending on what level you're looking at and what part of the market and what their use case is. So last week, we had a little bit of a warning sign out of Micron, which talked about slowing demand for issues like computers and smartphones, suggesting maybe a little bit of a weaker demand outlook for memory-related chips in particular. Now, you mentioned before, we just had Samsung come out, better-than-expected jump in revenue, so that's a positive sign for this group. So again, some mixed signals there, but this is an area where people are still trying to suss out what does demand look like and so on and so forth. Now, of course, there are other areas we can get into those as well.
I feel like a story like yours, Ryan, is one that really kind of educates us, because it reminds us that not all chips are the same, and then it also reminds us that this is when it really turns out that if you're a big buyer of chips, thank you, Apple, you tend to be in a better position. So talk to us a little bit about kind of the specifics, the nuances of the semi-trade.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, you mentioned that Apple is a huge buyer of chips, especially from Micron and from Qualcomm and from other names like that. Because of the weight it throws around, it has been able to navigate some of these supply chain issues a little bit better than smaller players, although in its most recent quarterly report, it did kind of come out and suggest that it was seeing a certain amount of headwind from this. Of course, now there's questions about demand and its ability to continue getting supply. So again, very complicated picture in the chip sector, but different areas are seeing perhaps some stronger tailwinds than others right now. It really depends on what the use case is.
Okay, Ryan, let's talk autos here. Help us get an understanding for what's going on in the car industry, specifically here in the United States, because it's still pretty tough to get a new car.
Yeah, absolutely. We just saw GM come out last week talking about chip shortages as being sort of an issue that it's facing. So that is an area where there continues to be extremely strong demand for chips, and there's more and more chips are being put into cars, especially electric vehicles, to monitor all the different kinds of computers and, everything that goes on in those cars to make sure that they're operating and finding all the necessary data they need. So that is an area that continues to see very strong demand that impacts companies like Texas Instruments, STM, Infineon, NXP, few companies like that that are heavily involved in this particular area.
All right. So you've got, you know, you talk about the different chips in your story, you know, smartphones, mm-hmm. tablets, computers. We just talked about auto. Tim brought that up. There's data centers. There's AI, artificial intelligence. And then you've also got the chip equipment makers. I almost think about when I'm reading this story, I think about the energy sector, right? You've got integrated oil companies. You've got the E&P, the exploration production companies. You've got utilities. Yeah. Like, there's different ways of playing with it. Talk to us about, like, the data center and AI guys or the chip equipment makers. Is that opportunity for investors potentially?
Well, data center is an area that so far seems to be holding up pretty well. Data centers, of course, use in cloud computing and so forth, so it has really major enterprise spending behind it, you know, especially names like Amazon and Microsoft and Alphabet are, of course, the biggest players within the cloud space. So companies like NVIDIA tend to see a lot of demand for these types of products. AMD is another one. Even Micron does have a data center division, which it said was holding up pretty well in contrast to the consumer side of things. So this is an area, you know, so far it's holding well. People I've spoken to said they are really waiting to see whether this continues to hold up. If it doesn't, then that does have some pretty negative implications for what broader economic growth looks like.
Yeah, I feel like, Tim, these are the things like the hedge fund guys, right? They're watching like all these different kind of indicators to give an idea of what comes next.
Exactly. And it's interesting to see, too, we didn't even get a chance to talk about crypto and the decline in interest around crypto, the decline in price around crypto. That has an effect on the chip industry as well, because that decreases demand, too.
Do you know the SOX is up more than 6% since last Friday?
I didn't know that. I'll find that out at 3 o'clock, I bet.
Maybe.
Sounds like a good one.
Might be a good sector for the top of that 3 p.m. simulcast. Ryan, thank you so much. Ryan Vostelica, he's equities reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from Chicago.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Demand destruction, anyone? Because this story is definitely a sign of the times as surging power bills are forcing the U.S. industrial complex to slow down. Tim, this is a story you will find on the Bloomberg Terminal online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It really is, just speaks to so much of what's going on. And I feel like what we just talked about for some of our audience.
High energy prices.
Yes.
The bane of industrial production. Joe Doe writes all about it along with Noreen Malik. Carol, as you mentioned, you can find this story at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Joe Doe is Metals and Agriculture America's deputy team leader for Bloomberg News. He joins us this afternoon. Also with us is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. This is remarkable, Joel. At one plant here in the U.S., the electricity bills have tripled in recent months, and as a result, they've had to idle the plant.
And more than one plant. This is going to have, and this is going to be a story that I think we're going to continue to talk about. I mean, look, like, the world is obsessed with the energy story right now. We've seen it just kind of devastate Europe. And what really got us interested in this story by Joe and Noreen was that some of these early signs are starting to show up here that the surging costs of electricity are going to kind of break America's industrial complex, and that factory might that makes America hum. So Joe, what are we wrestling with here, and what are those factories and manufacturers looking at?
Yeah, I think it's the first time the United States is seeing a power crunch itself, right? Europe, obviously, it hit very early on with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and then this spread into Asia. And for months now, our European colleagues have been calling us on the commodities desk here in the United States saying, aren't you guys seeing similar problems for your steel mills and for your aluminum mills and all the other manufacturing facilities? And we kept saying, no, it's just not happening. Well, when Century Aluminum, which is the second largest U.S. aluminum producer in the United States, just a few weeks ago announced that they were closing down their largest facility due to power costs, Noreen and I got on a call and said, what are we missing here? And so this is ultimately what became this story. And she had been learning already previously that a lot of manufacturers across the Midwest were complaining about their power costs. They weren't shutting down necessarily, but they were worried they were going to have to throttle things back in the summer. And of course, what our story goes into is that not only are they feeling these, but they are actually, you are starting to see some shuttering of manufacturing production across the U.S., including one source telling me that two finishing facilities for steelmakers have already had to cut back on production because they need to cut in some places so they can continue to do, you know, their main work.
Joe, what I love about your story is I learn about within the industrial complex here in the United States, kind of how it all works. And especially when you're, you know, tapping into utilities and power, I mean, facilities have to pay for something, as you lay out, something known as capacity. So in other words, they kind of need to keep things functioning even if they don't need to use it.
Yeah, it's the way we describe it is an insurance policy. So if you're a big factory, or let's say you're a, you're a utility, right? And you need to make sure that in the middle of August, the entire city of New York has enough power to turn on all of their air conditionings on a 100-degree humid day. Well, you have to pay ahead of time to make sure that that capacity will be there if you need it. And what we're finding, because the grid is aging, because we've been phasing out old fossil fuel plants, you know, because of the war between Russia and Ukraine, all of these things are converging and pushing up the cost even of the capacity. So you combine the capacity, which is an insurance that you sometimes need, but sometimes you don't need, and you add that with what you're actually paying per kilowatt hour, and it's really just stressing these companies.
And I'm curious here, Joe, like, when are we going to know how bad this gets? Like, right, we're early right now, right? Like, how bad could this get?
So the forecast that we had pointed out, which was a government forecast, said the worst is yet to come, and it's probably going to come here in the third quarter, towards the end of the summer, as obviously power use goes up to its highs. And it's going to hit a high of all time. This is something I was just discussing earlier with Bloomberg Television, which is, well, what does that mean, right? And I think we're going to be paying very close attention to earnings in the next coming weeks for the big manufacturing companies, in which they'll tell us, you know, all they've said all year is that demand is good and order books remain healthy. But we're actually starting to see economic data show a bit of a slowdown in the economy. Obviously, GDP was negative. And it's going to start. The question will come up from analysts. Well, what about your power contracts? Are those starting to be a problem for you? Does that mean you're going to have to shut down? And are you getting it on the other end, which is demand? And, you know, listen, I'm not saying that it's for sure, right? Things could turn and maybe suddenly things improve. But right now, it's like Noreen wrote in our story, there's just not enough renewables out there to offset what's going on right now, and people are going to start feeling the pain.
Well, let's talk about some of those renewables here, because I do like how the two of you wrote about a potential silver lining here, the idea of investment, perhaps, in renewables, barges full of batteries, startups getting investment as a result of this. Help us find the silver lining here, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, the silver lining is that comes online. The bad part of that silver lining is it comes online over a number of years. And it's not something that can just happen now. And I know we've all been having this conversation this year, especially in Europe, right, which is the short-term pain. Suddenly, everybody's looking back. Fossil fuels, right? We need power now. And that's the struggle. So eventually, we are going to get important solar coming online, and we're going to have important wind coming online. And these things, included with the ability to store all of that power, are really going to change the dynamics of the grid. But at this moment, it's just not there. And that's why you're feeling this squeeze.
That's right. And we're like far from that. So look, if this is going to hit industry, Joe, like, what do we expect? Is this something that consumers are going to feel, the energy prices, or are they going to have the knock-on effects of suddenly, like, this becoming yet another thing that plays into, you know, inflation and inflationary concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I'll put it this way. They could feel it. You know, you could see a pass-through of costs, but that won't happen if demand suddenly dissipates even before then, right? If you have real concerns of an already problematic issue of inflation, you have the already problematic slowdown in the economy. Suddenly, if that demand disappears, then passing through those costs maybe isn't entirely possible, and maybe suddenly you're looking at cutting back on a lot of manufacturing capacity. I mean, listen, this is pure speculation, but I am kind of playing out the potential possibilities here.
Well, and it certainly seems to start, you know, fitting in with some of the other economic data points that we're starting to get about the global economy, certainly in the U.S. economy. Joe Doe, thank you so much. Metals and Agriculture America's deputy team leader at Bloomberg News, along with Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. This story you can find on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, full disclosure, I didn't do a lot of reading while I was sick out with COVID, to be quite honest. I did periodically say, hey, Google, give me a news update. And when I did yesterday, that's when I heard about Amazon and Grubhub teaming up. I got to say, though, Tim, we're still trying to figure out, you know, what this relationship does and means.
And can New Yorkers actually get it? Grubhub right. And Seamless are the same company, but it can't get it on Seamless. You know, we're trying to figure out what's going on. Fortunately, we've got a great person to help us do that. Jackie DeVallos is technology reporter for Bloomberg News. She's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So this is a great day two story, Jackie, because I think a lot of people who were paying attention yesterday understand the news that Grubhub and Amazon have teamed up for Amazon Prime customers to get what, free Grubhub delivery?
Absolutely. At the end of the day, for customers, this is a much better deal. Prime has a really impressive, very loyal membership base of Prime subscribers. I mean, you can get your shampoo, toilet paper, and now you can get your dinner delivered. So at a time where people are really pinching pennies, you don't want to have to be paying, you know, fee after fee,
right,
tips. And so this is just a good way to clean it up and provide a deal to their customers.
Okay, so what's in it for Grubhub and for Amazon?
Well, this is an especially good deal for Grubhub. They have been needing a lifeline of sorts. If you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, they lost a ton of market share to DoorDash and Uber Eats, and especially in their top markets like New York and Chicago. So they've really been looking for ways to kind of get some of those customers back and keep them on. And they've still been struggling. Their pairing company has been looking to sell them, and no one's really up for the buy right now. And so this is not only a good way to kind of really boost that user base again, but also make them a more attractive acquisition target for other companies.
Grubhub is like, I finally got a date. Thank God for the big dance. So there's a little bit of that going on. But I also feel like for Amazon, man, they are thinking so much about how to hold on to all of us who are part of the Amazon Prime deal.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of us forget that they actually did wade into the food delivery industry
that.
A while ago.
It didn't work.
It didn't, unfortunately. It was back in 2015, and you know, it was called Amazon Restaurants. And you know, Jeff Bezos himself was really reticent to get into the space because if you think about it, the moment a hot meal gets to your door, it's a toss-up. It could be perfect, or you know, if you order sushi on the wrong day, it could really just ruin that Prime experience for Prime subscribers. And so he didn't invest a lot into it. And it kind of folded. And so this is kind of a way of inching back into the space for sure.
So for Amazon, it's kind of like, yeah, I'm going to date you a little bit, but I've got to back up.
Absolutely.
Like, or I can back out at any moment. I mean, it just feels like, because having been homesick, I did a lot of ordering of food. And man, so many times things are messed up.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's pretty interesting how they structured this partnership. They didn't exactly take a stake outright. It's an initial option to do so through warrants. And then they can increase that up to 15% if things go well. So it's, you know, a lot of protection, and it's a cautious move in. But absolutely, for us that, you know, are so used to going on DoorDash or Uber Eats and rapid delivery now, it's just going to bring that, you know, fee notch down a notch a bit.
Okay, so what does this mean for Amazon Prime customers who are getting that price hike up to $139 a year at a time? When, in your own words, Jackie, customers are pinching pennies because everything is more expensive right now. Does this make that Amazon Prime subscription that much more valuable and somebody less likely to cut their Prime sub?
I think overwhelmingly yes, because when you think about how much that Grubhub Plus membership is worth, you don't just get free delivery. You get a slew of other perks and deals, and that's worth $9.99 a month. That pays for itself if you order, you know, at least 3 to 4 times a week, which many people do. And so for Prime subscribers that have already dealt with this Prime increase, this is just an added bonus and, you know, just a free perk for a service that many of us use.
So what does it mean for the other food services? Have you like been thinking about, you know, what does this mean for other players, either in big tech or other world, I don't know, that Amazon competes with, or just the other food delivery services? Are they kind of need to be thinking about maybe hooking up with someone?
It ups the ante a bit, because I think many had thought that Grubhub was just kind of a dead asset at this point. And given they've lost so much market share, this kind of puts them back in the game in a way. And, you know, you saw it in DoorDash and Uber's stock price yesterday. They were under pressure a bit because, you know, if you're going to have a partner, you want it to be a logistics giant like Amazon.
Interesting. And I wonder about the logistics part of this, because Amazon does have that part figured out. But delivering food is tough. Margins are really tight. And there is a lot of competition, Jackie. Just in the last 30 seconds, does this tell us anything about what Amazon's ambitions are? Not for food delivery, but for last mile, an area that it really has covered?
I think it means that they're looking to get into a space that has had a tough time figuring out how to make the economics work. And they already have a really big network of drivers. And so expanding into something like this can only help, especially as they're looking to tap other areas of growth.
So I'm going to order like my paper towels, and I'm going to get like a salad along with it.
Maybe some sushi too, Carol.
Some sushi. Oh my God. It's just Amazon taking over the world. Anyway, it's really kind of cool to see how this is all evolving. Jackie DeVolis, technology reporter at Bloomberg News, back in our Interactive Brokers studio. I don't know, Tim, what do you think?
Look, it makes sense. A question that I have just over and over again is what this means for Seamless, which is a Grubhub company.
Yeah.
And because that's what we use here in New York, so... is it going to work here?
I don't know.
I'll have to try it out because I'm a Prime subscriber.
Exactly. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg
Radio.
All right, we've got just about 10 and a half minutes left in the Thursday trade. Carol Masser along with Tim Stenovic right here on Bloomberg Business Week. And Tim, we've got stocks up, bonds down, yields moving up. I'm trying to figure out which trade do I trust. I mean, that sounds about right, right? If stocks go up, bonds typically go down. But I'm trying to figure out which one really has it right.
Maybe Brad McMillan has the answer for you. He's joining us now. He's Chief Investment Officer at Commonwealth Financial Network. Brad joining us on the phone from Waltham, Massachusetts. Commonwealth has got approximately $232.5 billion in assets under management. Brad, how are you?
I'm doing great. I hope you guys are having a good summer, too.
We are. We are.
Well, we're not. Look, no, we're not, because we both are dealing with COVID issues.
But we are healthy. Our families are healthy. And that's certainly what's important here, Brad. But, you know, you ask and you get the answer you might not want with us. OK, that's the thing here.
Let's
talk markets. Help bring us up to speed about what you're seeing, not just in the trade today, but the recent trend that we're seeing. And I'll ask you the question that I ask everyone. Is the worst behind us?
I think the worst is behind us for a couple of reasons. First of all, when you look at everything that's been driving this, you know, it's really been about interest rates so far. And, you know, inflation is starting to top out. We're seeing commodities start to pull back. We're seeing supply chains normalize. The Fed has pretty much been as hawkish as they can be. So fears are going to go down. And when interest rates start to stabilize, that gives us the ability to start moving ahead. And I think that's where we are now. Most of the damage has been done.
Okay, but the impact of that damage can stick around for a while, and that has certainly been the case of higher inflation. So even if we come down a bit, we're still at pretty high levels. Maybe not historically, but certainly high compared to recent history. So that damage on the economy as well as on the markets can stick around for a while. Fair?
I think that's fair, and I think you're absolutely right, Carol. That's what drove the market last month. It's more about, are we going to get a recession, and what's that going to do to earnings, than what are interest rates doing, and what does that mean for valuations? That damage is done. But I would argue the economy still has a ton of momentum, and a lot of that fear is overdone.
Where are you seeing that momentum right now? Because, you know, we just had this great story from our own Joe Doe in Bloomberg Business Week talking about higher energy prices are actually leading to the closure of some industrial firms because those prices have tripled that they're paying. We see food costs going up. Tell me where you're seeing the bright spots right now. And look, we know that consumers did a good job saving during the pandemic, but they can only pay for $5 a gallon gas for so long.
Absolutely true. But the one bright spot that we're looking at here is employment. And yes, I know the jobs report is coming up. I get that. But if you look at where we've been, we've continued to add jobs at about 400,000 a month. That's about twice the pace of what we were doing before the pandemic. And we still have millions of jobs available. So, you know, we don't typically get a recession as long as people are working and can work. And I think until we see the employment market turn around, I'm betting against a recession.
So what does that mean in terms of betting your financial bets? What does that mean you're advising clients to do, or how are you putting, you know, their money to work? Excuse me.
Well, when you look at the markets, I mean, there's been a lot of fear about what bonds have done. Okay, fair enough. We've seen an unprecedented trade down in bonds, but why was that? That was because interest rates moved up, and now it seems to be that interest rates are normalizing. So bonds, all of a sudden, you're getting paid more than you've been paid in a while. I don't mind bonds at this point. When you look at stocks, okay, stocks are now cheaper than they've been in the past couple of years, and all of a sudden, the earning yields, the free cash flow yields, are competitive with what we're seeing in bonds. In other words, I look at a market, and I see a normal market with some potential moving ahead. I don't see a ticking time bomb, which is what, you know, a lot of the coverage is suggesting.
Okay, so let's talk about what you're going to start to see here. Carol had the great question about, you know, where to put money right now. I want to go back to your macro outlook because you have it sounds like you're really optimistic. You're much more optimistic than a lot of the people that we've spoken to. But you're also speaking in a way that a lot of our people who cover the Fed and cover economics think, which is with, you know, 500,000 people added to the payrolls every month so far this year, it's hard to look like the U.S. is in a recession right now. When do you start to worry? Is it if we get a softer than expected jobs report tomorrow, or do those numbers have to start going negative each month?
I think I'm going to continue to be reasonably cheerful as long as job growth stays above 200,000 a month.
Okay.
Okay. As long as the number of jobs out there available stay in the millions. That says to me businesses are hiring and people are working. So if we go below 200, that means we're going below pre-pandemic levels, and that's when I start to pay attention.
Okay. So, I mean, I do feel like we don't have the playbook on all of this, right? You know, pandemic, coming out of a pandemic, you know, taking away unprecedented amounts of stimulus that was different stimulus from the financial crisis. Is it fair to say, though, you know, some of what we're doing right now, we're really making some big guesses?
Oh, absolutely. You know, but the thing is, Carol, that is always the case. So for all the sense that, you know, we know what's going to happen, we can make some educated guesses, and overall we do pretty well. But when we get into situations right now, I think you have to go back to the fundamentals, and that's why I am where I am. You know, I can tell you a lot of scary stories, but businesses are still hiring. People are still working. People are getting raises. You know, things are getting better, not worse. And I think that's ultimately where I've got to stand.
I like the optimism here. Okay, apart from job declines or 200K a month, where else should we be keeping an eye on just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you, Brad?
I think oil prices are the big one.
Okay.
You know, the question really is Russia going to change the oil market structurally going forward? And we don't know yet. That's the big negative wild card in my mind.
Yeah, I think that's a big one. I agree with you. We got to run. Hey, Brad, good to check in with you, get your thoughts and your perspective. And I do like the level-headed feel of it. Brad McMillan, Chief Investment Officer at Commonwealth Financial Network, joining us on the phone from Waltham, Massachusetts, and roughly $232.5 billion in assets under management.
Glasses half full for Brad.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.